surveillance initiated.
A British military test pilot turned astronaut blasts into space.
Ignition.
65 years after Dan Dare made his first appearance on the front of the Eagle comic, Britain had a true space hero.
Reaction from the families and the VIPs at Baikonur.
I'm Richard Hollingham. I'm a science and space reporter. That's me commentating for the European Space Agency as British astronaut Tim Peake entered his new home on the International Space Station in December 2015.
Crew getting the go from Mission Control Houston to open the airlock door. It's the crew lock now already down to vacuum. You can see the protective cover opening up.
Okay, so Major Tim wasn't blasting off in the Anastasia to battle the Mekon, but his mission showed that maybe the reality is finally catching up with the Dan Dare universe. People now live and work in space, with private companies increasingly leading the way. And even Britain has its own space program, although not a space fleet secretly being constructed at Duxford, at least as far as we know.
You can take the blindfold off now, Colonel Dare.
I don't know why you're bothered, sir. I'd have been interested to see New Duxford from the air.
How did you...
11 minutes north-northeast of London at 350 miles per hour. What else could it be?
Well, needless to say, official secrets and all that, take your firstborn, etc.
Understood, sir.
In Dan Dare, 21st Century Spaceman, I'll be meeting a rocket engineer inspired by the original Dan Dare comic strip and discovering how plasma drives could become a reality. I'll also be talking to the director and one of the writers behind the new audio dramas about the challenge of bringing Dare up to date. And the cast give their views on realising these enduring characters for the modern world.
The brilliant thing about the title, Dan Dare, is that you get it. You just hear the title, you get it. It's the ultimate high-concept pitch.
Along with Bev Doyle, Richard Curty is one of the lead writers of the audio adventures. I started by talking to him and series director and producer, Andrew Mark Saul.
You accept what the modern audience is and what they're interested in, and you bring these great, timeless, heroic qualities and you put them into a modern context. From day one, we always talked about keeping the heroism, keeping the idealism, keeping the optimism, but make it completely at one with the modern world. So business interests and no class structure and things are driven by money and irreverence is much more to the fore. No doffing caps or anything. All that stuff had to go whilst you kept the essentials that made the stories work.
Did you draw up, Andrew, a list as producer of things that would stay and things that would go? Did you have meetings with whiteboards working out, right, we're going to keep that, we're not going to keep that? How did they work?
We couldn't have thought of whiteboards. This is radio. We had actually a year of planning with a team of writers. We had a writer's room of writers we've worked with in the past and some new writers we actually brought into the fold. And we literally sort of looked at and discussed what excited us about the original Dan Dare and what we needed to actually update to make it relevant for today without losing the essential DNA that is Dan Dare. What was really important about that was that by the time we'd actually finished those kind of discussions, we had nailed down the wireframe of what our Dan Dare world would be.
A little while ago, long-range sensors picked up a spatial quantum effect. It caused a temporary shutdown of all onboard systems.
It was pretty hairy there. For a moment, I thought we were goners.
Luckily, the emergency backup systems came online and there are no reports of any damage to the station.
Nor any injuries to personnel.
But we now know that it wasn't just us. This was a massive event, setting off alarms all over the place.
Some kind of attack from our green friend?
Not unless he's set up on another planet. The origin point from the quantum effect was on Mars.
But there's nothing out there. Except for half a dozen dead beagles and the odd explorer robot.
There was a lot of feather ruffling in those writers' rooms. You know, Bev and I would keep coming up and saying, no, you want to chuck this way, and you want to chuck that away, and we're not interested in that. And you could feel people's hackles bristling. But we found if you ruffle feathers enough, people just get used to it, and then they do come around to your way of thinking.
Yeah, and also by ruffling feathers and by challenging people's set views and things, it does actually, and get them out of their comfort zone, it makes them rethink and hopefully, and in our case, be inspired. And I think that, I mean, one of the comments has been made from some of the early reviews is that people have been surprised that it's a sort of old-fashioned type of storytelling. Now, I actually think there's nothing wrong with old-fashioned storytelling. I get a bit kind of bored with these convoluted, overly complicated plots. I actually would like a beginning, middle, and end and actually know what's gone on and not be scratching my brow by the end of it. I also think there's nothing wrong with just having a good, rollicking action-adventure tale. And I remember going to see Guardians of the Galaxy, which was a little-known Marvel comic that burst onto the scene with little kind of fanfare. Nobody really knew what it was about. And it was just brilliant fun. It had its tongue firmly in its cheek. It was sharply written. There was a real economy of writing, and it cracked along at a Gatling pace. And I came out of it with a sort of just a feel-good feeling. I'd had a couple of hours of solid entertainment. And that's what we hope that we bring to Dan Dare, the audio adventures, that people come away from having listened to an hour or 6.5 hours of Dan Dare, feeling they've actually invested their time wisely and actually had a hell of a lot of fun, and being introduced to an iconic British space hero.
Now we're getting somewhere.
Ease off. That's an order.
The only way to find a breaking point is to nudge right up to it.
There. Land the plane.
Like that.
Immediately.
With pleasure, Mom. Now that we know for sure those billions were well spent.
Dan Dare was originally created by a Lancashire vicar, Reverend Marcus Morris, with writer and artist Frank Hampson. The character first appeared in the New Eagle comic in April 1950. The magazine went on to sell more than 1 million copies a week to eager schoolchildren.
I went into the attic this morning to get this out. I don't venture in there very much these days. But what I have here are my originals.
Founder of Reaction Engines Limited, Alan Bond, is one of Britain's foremost spacecraft engineers, a real-life rocket scientist, thanks in large part to Dan Dare.
As you can see within this box, there's my very first part of the Operation Saturn adventure.
That's pretty much held together with sellotape.
It's pretty much sellotape together, and that is an indication of how much thumbing it got when I was, back in 1953 when I was sort of 8 years old.
It looks almost like an ancient relic.
I guess in many respects that's actually what it is.
This is Hampson Station. Please identify yourself. Just the ID, please.
It's Nautilus. But it disappeared over 10 years ago, out by Jupiter.
Oh, she can't have just drifted in again. We'd have tracked her.
Something has brought her back.
So, the date on this one is the 13th of March, 1953.
And this is Dan Dare, Pilot of the Future, Operation Saturn.
Yes, and this was the first adventure I came in contact with. And it's probably psychological, but I still think this is one of the better of the Dan Dare adventures.
Lockwave engine, disengage.
My God. That was just astounding.
Inspired by Dan Dare, as a teenager, Alan built his own rockets before going on to work in the rocket department at Rolls-Royce. Today, with backing from the British government and European Space Agency, Reaction Engines is developing a new type of spacecraft.
Frank Hampson with Dan Dare, he sort of set a requirement, if you like. This is what spaceflight has got to look like. You've got to be able to go out to the launch site, climb into your spaceship, and 2 hours later sort of be in space on the mission that you're supposed to be doing. And so I regard the Eagle and quite a few other things at that time, like Journey into Space, as specifying the way that we'd like to see spaceflight. So all my life I've been sort of working towards trying to do that, and of course have come closest to it with Skylon and the Sabre engines and so on.
Skylon even looks a bit like a Dan Dare spaceship. Fitted with wings and advanced air-breathing Sabre engines, it's designed to take off from a runway and deliver satellites to orbit at a fraction of the cost of conventional rockets.
Now, I love this. This is a pop-up book you've got. Yes, so again, I guess this is from, it looks, again, quite early, 1950s again?
It was a Christmas present. My brothers were much older than me, so I had a quite elderly sister-in-law, and she bought me this for Christmas.
So it's beautiful. It opens up. You've got the rocket taking off. That doesn't look unlike maybe a Saturn V or something like that, apart from all the windows at the top of the rocket.
Absolutely. The only difference with these is these are single-stage orbit rockets, which we've never managed to achieve. But you're quite right that in terms of the actual launch, etc., it doesn't look all that different. However, you can see here there are three rockets taking off together. And in terms of the spectacular exhaust, I don't think Frank Hampson quite appreciated what the launch of a rocket of this scale would actually look like. You can see there are still people down here.
Yes, people very close.
Going about their ordinary everyday business. We've got the man on the gate here sort of holding up a gyro car at the stop sign.
Again, that's quite British, isn't it? Sort of British officialdom represented as this rocket takes. You can imagine the sort of the bureaucrats in the foreground there.
Absolutely.
Many nations were subjugated by the alien menace, but we showed the world the people of Britain would not be defeated. Now, let us first salute the brave men and women of Interplanet Space Fleet. Sir Hubert, to you we owe our very freedom.
The Britishness is very important, Dandere, because if you look at movies, when we're so used to seeing movies about American military, American Marines, and then you see movies about the British military, and it's a whole different ball of wax in a very interesting way, and the different values that come through. And I think we wanted to try and reflect that in this. This is a very much a British European program with its those kind of values, that kind of sense of humor. I think that's what might make it stand out a little bit from a lot of the other Americans own space. You know, if you look at all the shows, you go, oh, the Americans own space. Actually, no, we're carving out a bit for us, and I think that's important.
Your father was a great test pilot.
So why didn't you tell that to the Inquiry?
They'd already made up their minds. The space program was going to be cancelled. Money had a lot to do with it. Dropping a spaceship on Birmingham just brought matters to a head.
They made my father a scapegoat.
You want to be careful who you accuse of what.
Today, looking at where Britain has landed, it's very hard to imagine that back in the 1950s and the early part of the 60s, it wasn't at all incredible that Britain could be leading the push into space. Not the Americans, but the British. Farnborough was doing remarkable things. We had our own launch vehicle programs, and we were developing, unfortunately, ballistic missile technology. But nonetheless, I myself was fortunate enough eventually to work on big rocket engine programs in this country. Now, as we went through into the 1960s and Harold Wilson started to review the economy and did all kinds of things that we can debate on another occasion, that is when Britain really sort of handed the baton to America. But we mustn't forget that in terms of many things, jet engines, aerodynamics of aircraft and so on, we were well ahead of the Americans at that point in time.
Lockwave engine disengaged.
My God, that was just astounding.
The whole ship was teleported across space, about 1 billion miles a minute. Of course it was astounding.
I'd say that has to qualify us for the Guinness Book of Records.
And there they are, the rings of Saturn.
Wow. And just, well, wow.
It's very, very difficult now. And even I have to think hard to see that when I read Dandere or listened to a rather similar programme, Journey into Space, on the radio, the idea that we wouldn't be the first people out onto the moon just never passed through anybody's mind.
Dandere was created 7 years before the first satellite, Sputnik, and more than 10 years before the first astronaut, Yuri Gagarin, blasted into orbit. In 1950, the only rockets most of the Eagle's young readers would be familiar with were the German V-2 missiles, used against Britain in the final months of the Second World War. Despite the original stories being more than 60 years old, director of the audio adventures, Andrew Mark Saul, says there are plenty of parallels with the world today.
it was an antidote to the sort of post-war austerity, and rationing was still in place, and the Red Menace, the fear of the Red Menace in Armageddon, and it was uncertain times. And Dan Dare was a figure of optimism and hope and an adventurer, and the sort of the ambition of venturing beyond the stars. And it was just a fantastic visionary stories, which was rooted in some real science and just good rollicking fun. And now we live in an equally uncertain time with the Brexit debacle, uncertainty in the world economy, ISIS and terrorism. There's real fear. And I think that a character like Dan Dare embodies some hope and optimism that we're in real need of. And I think also that now with the interest in Tim Peake and the International Space Station, people's interest in space and exploration of space has been reignited in a way that I remember I had that kind of passionate interest with the moon landings in the 60s and 70s.
Let's go straight over to Kingfisher, the latest ramjet prototype, where brave test pilot Dan Dare is putting the beast through its paces. Much to the horror of the flight controllers.
Ease off, Dare. Ease off.
But our intrepid hero is undaunted.
The Dan Dare character was originally imagined by Marcus Morris as a kind of religious superhero, Lex Christian. This evolved into Space Chaplain Dan Dare, and eventually Colonel Dan Dare, pilot of the future. Morris and Hampson probably realised that a space pilot leading daring missions is more likely to be a commercial success than a spacefaring vicar.
With the launch date approaching, we need to ease the space programme out of the shadows, which is where you come in, Colonel Dare.
Handsome young pilot to capture the public imagination and all that.
We don't want to miss a trick.
So I'm just a marketing gimmick?
No, 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 no. You're the brave commander who'll make first contact with an alien species.
A bold step into the future.
Remarkable moment in human history.
Which is why we need someone who's easy on the eye.
Easy on the eye?
My name is Robert Slade, and I'm playing Colonel Tom Stanks, who is Dan Dare's mentor, the old-timer.
Colonel Dare, good to see you again.
And you, Major.
A professor these days. Now I'm running the academy here.
Training the next generation of space explorers. Exciting stuff.
Yeah, hold that thought until you've met some of the cadets. These kids have no respect for the old days. Hence what they call me behind my back. Old-timer.
Charming.
Dan is he's one of those icons of principle and character. He's a character for all time, even though he was originally set in that dawn of space exploration.
Whew, tough crowd.
Holographic interface.
Welcome back.
Can't believe Sir H has me doing a glad-handing tour without leaving orbit.
But you're the man of the moment. Britain's astronaut hero. No one ever mentions that Peabody and me were even there.
Want to swap places? It can be arranged.
Not bloody likely. Dan Dare is interesting as a modern hero.
Jeff McGiven plays Digby in the audio adventures and admits he's old enough to remember the original Dan Dare stories.
He is very straight up and down. He's an old-fashioned, straight as a die, this is right, that is wrong. And you might think that he's very much of his time and is outdated. But if you think about it, if you think of any of the modern heroes that we have, they're heroes. They don't do the bad thing. Can't think of any time when Harrison Ford's surprised everybody by doing something horrendous for convenience sake. He doesn't. He does the right thing. If you're going to have a straight-ahead story that you want people to remain interested in, he's got to do the good thing. Or she. Buffy has to slay the vampire. If she doesn't, what's the point of her?
But you don't know how it works.
I'm a test pilot. I can drive anything.
Or destroy anything.
I think that he starts off with selfish intent, which is he's had 10 years of trying to get into the space program. He finally has that opportunity. He's quite gung-ho about it. And then he realizes that he's actually quite possibly the salvation of the human race. So he represents the salvation of the human race, and that there's more to just being a bloody good space pilot. He has to get in touch with his humanity.
I'm Ed Stoppard, and I am playing Colonel Dan Dare, pilot of the future. One of the things that first attracted me to this project was the idea of playing a kind of heroic character. I don't have the impression of having played many heroic characters over the years, and I certainly haven't done very much sci-fi. So the idea of playing a heroic character in a science fiction story was just too good an opportunity to pass up, really.
Is there something in us, do you think? Some flaw in our species? I have to wonder. Oh, I'm proud to be a pilot, proud of my friends, but too often this job feels dirty.
Dan has a very sort of distinct moral centre. I think he probably does see the world, ethically speaking, in quite sort of absolute terms. You know, one can either behave in a benevolent fashion or a malevolent fashion. And it's probably a little less shades of grey, certainly, than someone like Digby would see the world. You know, I suspect he feels that that is a strength. He finds, you know, the sort of political expediency or, you know, the machinations of corporations for their own ends and that kind of thing a bit distasteful, or very distasteful, really. And so I suppose, you know, he's really quite a selfless character and sort of expects the same behaviour from others.
Everything has to pay its way, but then I wouldn't expect a flyboy like you to understand. Too much time with your head in the clouds.
I'd rather have my head in the clouds than stuck down a test tube.
As a matter of fact, Peabody isn't just a scientist. She's research director for the Eagle Corporation. They're actually paying for all this.
Which technically makes me your boss.
You privatized the space program.
One of the biggest changes the writers made in translating the original stories is the nature of Eagle, which has gone from comic to corporation, where space is not necessarily for all mankind.
Don't get all high and mighty. He's a pragmatist, as am I. Corporate profit is the only reason we even came to Venus.
Maybe some things shouldn't be for sale.
I don't make the rules.
But you're happy to follow them?
No money, no space exploration. That's just the way it is, the way the world works.
One of the drivers for me was looking at how the space race was being reignited and the potential and future corporatization of the space race is damn expensive. You've got China, you've got India, you've got all these other countries are getting involved, but you've also got these private companies. You've got Richard Branson with Virgin, you've got SpaceX. And I thought, well, if you take that forward 30, 40 years' time, corporates are going to be controlling and funding the space race. You can see it as a logical evolution, but there are consequences of that.
Colonel, dare do you read?
Go ahead, Scott.
Sir, Anastasia's radar just picked up another vessel coming in fast from high orbit.
One of ours?
Not exactly. It's broadcasting an Eagle Corporation transponder.
They must have followed us from Earth orbit. Lifted off soon after we left.
Daniel, listen to me. Eagle Corp. Whatever they tell you, whatever they promise, don't trust them.
Come on, Peabody, back on board. Let's head for home. Well, as close as we can get. We can leave the politics and explanations to Sir Hubert. And don't worry about me, Uncle. I'm beginning to get pretty picky about who I trust.
There was a lot of argument in the writer's room about the role of corporations, because as soon as we brought it up, there was a knee-jerk reaction to kind of go, corporate is bad. And we've really fought hard against that because Elon Musk is kind of go, fantastic, that's the great side of corporate. Donald Trump, that's the bad side of corporate. And what we didn't want to do is to slip into that thing of corporate is bad, because actually good capitalism is a huge enabler of fantastic things. So I think that ambivalence does run through the series. What do we think of Peabody? Is she a force for good or not? And that does run through the series. And in different writers' hands, in different episodes, she's treated slightly differently because it depends on where you stand on the politics of that. So that's a bit of a live issue, I think, still.
And this is Professor Peabody, yes? A fellow scientist.
Not a scientist like you. Not ever.
You would do best to curb that aggressive hostility. Our exalted supreme leader speaks with admiration of your intellect and logical rigor.
He knows nothing.
He knows more than you could ever comprehend. Take them through.
From the early days of the Eagle comic, Professor Peabody has remained a three-dimensional character equal to the men, not there to look pretty, scream at the monsters, or as someone for the hero to explain the plot to.
Miss Peabody, I think you're still woozy from being rendered unconscious.
Don't patronise me, sir.
I've been looking at some old files, and I think there's clear evidence of alien technologies predating Sondar's crash.
You're connecting dots that just aren't there.
Really? There are things you've not told us. I want to know what they are. We all want to know.
Professor Peabody, do I need to remind you that you are an employee of the Eagle Corps, not a member of the ISF?
And your point?
Perhaps you should be directing your questions to the Eagle Board rather than to me.
Is that it? You're giving me the brush off.
I'm giving you some friendly advice. Drop this.
With all due respect, sir, go to hell.
Through science fiction and British science fiction, the one lonely sort of female participant sort of shows up as brilliant. Everybody respects the fact that she is far superior intellectually to Dan Dare or any of the rest of the team. So, I mean, that is really quite amazing.
Once again, perhaps, the Dan Dare comic strip was ahead of its time. As it turned out, the first British astronaut was a woman, Helen Sharman, a scientist like Jocelyn Peabody.
She is a modern woman with modern ideals in a male bastion society. I think that's a fantastic and fascinating dynamic to explore.
Analysis complete.
I knew I was right. Computer, open log.
Recording.
Digital models have confirmed my initial diagnosis.
My name is Heather Reed, and I play Professor Peabody.
The Mekon strain is...
Nasty. Is that what's running around inside us?
Pause log recording. Yes, Digby, that is a virtual model of our little problem.
I think she is first and foremost a scientist. She loves her job very much and she is hungry for discovery constantly, you know, so she gets very excited about new things that she's discovered, which is very fun to play. And she's very much a woman of her time, you know, she's strong and independent and doesn't take shit from anyone.
Did he say robot bugs?
I'm going out there.
I'll come with you.
No. You're the brains of this outfit. We're the trigger pullers. Secure the hatch behind me. Stay quiet.
Are you sure you don't want me to put the kettle on?
I heard that.
Peabody starts out as kind of a company woman, you know, working for the Eagle Corps, very much sort of ticking boxes. But on her travels with Dan and Digby, they encounter so much and get into so many incredible situations that she softens somewhat, and I think her perspective changes a little bit, and you know, she becomes a little bit more flexible. She thinks she knows everything to start with, you know, she thinks she's got it all figured out. She soon realizes she doesn't, and I think that's what, you know, humbles her and makes her easier to get along with in the end.
He comes to really value her, I think, as a friend and as someone he can rely on and as someone with great insight and intelligence and courage. As with Digby, you know, he becomes very fond of both of them. And I suppose the word I'm looking for is a team. They very much become a team.
What exactly is your role on this mission?
Crew security and weaponry.
But there's no need for weapons.
There's always a need for weapons.
This is a peaceful mission.
Prepare for the worst and you won't be disappointed. That's my motto, and I've been in most of the wars going this last 20 years.
I can see this is going to be a cheerful trip.
Suicide missions rarely are, sir.
I wouldn't know. Always make a landing you can walk away from. That's my motto.
I play Albert Fitzwilliam Digby.
Jeff McGiven.
Digby is sceptical, sees a glass as half empty, which I find quite sympathetic, and is a staunch ally and friend, and is a pleasure to play because he's also funny occasionally, because his bluff doer, seen it all, not impressed. Digby has been around, he says at one point, I've been in most wars of the last 20 years and I've seen everything. And that's a very enjoyable part to play when you're confronted by stick insect people, because he doesn't regard them as so much alien as somebody you can say, how do, and be interested in them. So he's not a xenophobe. So it's been an absolute pleasure discovering Digby.
What is that?
You better ask Peabody. She let her in.
Her name is Ergulux.
Erga who?
Ergulux.
She's a native Mercurian.
Right. How do?
Meanwhile, somewhere in South London...
We're in an amazing place that most people have no idea that it exists at all. We're in the headquarters of the British Interplanetary Society and in the library, which is an absolute treasure trove.
There are shelves of books on every aspect of space exploration, models of spacecraft and pictures of concept space stations. There's even a letter from one of the founders of the American space program, Wernher von Braun. This is the place to come to understand the past, present and future of space exploration. I'm here to find out how much of Dander is rooted in reality. My guide is Jerry Stone, a fellow of the Society and regular recipient of the Eagle Annual during his childhood in the 1960s.
I was 14 years old when Apollo 11 landed on the moon. And it was a Sunday night, and the landing took place about 9:45. So about an hour later, I got sent off to bed. Once everyone else had gone to bed, I actually crept back downstairs quietly, put the TV on with the sound turned down, and stayed up through the night. So I consider myself to be very privileged to have been able to watch live as men from Earth walked for the first time in history on the surface of another world.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
And so you've, reading Dan Dare, the Eagle Annuals, albeit not the magazine, you're seeing men walk on the moon. So all this must have seemed like it could become reality, that Dan Dare was really happening.
Yes, that ultimately this is what would happen. And there'd been von Braun's descriptions of how we would build these huge ships to take up the parts to assemble the space station. And from there we would go on to the moon and to Mars. And obviously that's the way to do it. It's a steady, progressive, step-by-step advancement through space. And if you're going to go out to the moon and set up a moon base there and go to Mars and at least fly by Venus, you know, we know now that we're not likely to set up a base on Venus, you could have a space fleet. And so that would need to be organised, and Dan there showed you how it would be done.
Down and stable.
Nicely done, Colonel.
A safe landing is included in the ticket price.
It's incredible. We are the first humans on Venus.
Mission Control, this is Anastasia. We made it. We're down safely.
Unfortunately, the path of space exploration hasn't quite gone the way the Eagle writers, its readers, or Wernher von Braun planned. But what makes Dan Dare relevant again today is that we're starting to get back on track to that 50s vision of how space should be.
People ask, well, you know, why aren't we on the moon now? You know, if we were able to do that 40 years ago? The simple answer is you can't do everything at once. And NASA put their efforts into the International Space Station. It was just recently that the president announced a goal of having humans on Mars in the early 2030s. And for people like me in the Mars Society who've been advocating this for years, this is great news. SpaceX announcing plans for rockets to send crafts that can hold 100 people to set up a community on other worlds. And in the case of the project that I'm looking at, out in free space, we're looking at designs for habitats that can hold 10,000 people and upwards. So we want to see humanity in space, and that's pretty much what Dan Dare took for granted. That was the background to their adventures. It was that mankind was out in the solar system, and that's what we want to see.
So are we on course to have a Dan Dare future, or at least some sort of future, as you were reading back in the 1960s and people were reading back in the 50s when Eagle first came out?
Now we really are genuinely looking at establishing large communities in space and on the moon and on Mars in the future. And if you're going to do that, then you need to be able to travel between them. Dr. Franklin Chang Diaz, who used to be a shuttle astronaut, his speciality was high-energy plasma physics, and his company has produced demonstration versions of the Vasimir plasma engine. And a full-scale version of that would mean that instead of taking 7 to 9 months to get to Mars, we could do it in 39 days. Now we are much, much closer to the Dandir vision.
Solid copy, Peak Station. Anastasia is now on internal power. Detach umbilical and mooring clamps.
Detaching in 3, 2, 1.
Good release. We're clear of the docking platform.
Engines are in the green. Hatches secured. Fusion reactor running at 97% power. We are looking good.
ISS command to all call signs in area of operations. Anastasia is free to engage plasma drives at minimum safe distance. Colonel there, you have clear skies. Good flying.
Given that in 1950 no one had actually built a proper spaceship yet, the original ships of the fleet resembled V-2 rockets and World War II bombers. In the audio adventures, we can imagine for ourselves what the Anastasia looks like. Crucial to this is how it sounds. The responsibility of sound designer Alistair Locke.
Like the TARDIS in Doctor Who or the Enterprise in Star Trek, she is a character without dialogue in her own right. So one of the challenges will be to give her a voice, if you like, her unique sound, so that you know that is the Anastasia, no matter what the ship is doing.
And for many fans of Dandare, the spaceships have been as important as the other characters and stories. Alan Bond again.
So, this was my Dandare spaceship builder. I think they're quite rare these days, and unfortunately some bits of this have been lost, but as you can see, that is quite a reasonable representation of one of the rockets that we've just been looking at in the comic.
So it's a metal construction kit, a bit like Meccano, but I guess it's not Meccano. It looks similar.
It is Meccano-like, but I don't know whether Meccano actually made it under a different name.
So you built this, you put the panels together, the nuts and bolts on. And
it came with a lot of panels and various sort of thrusters that you could screw onto it and so on. Some of it has been lost, unfortunately. There were several different configurations of spaceship that you could make. That's the sort of sole surviving bit of kit that's left. I think I've still got a spare thruster here from one of the other configurations,
yes, a little bit.
Which is a rather larger one.
And this Dandare tin, now this is quite interesting.
The Dandare tooth powder, which was actually quite expensive and actually not very nice tasting.
So this is a bit like toothpaste, but a powder rather than a paste.
That's right. When you open it, there's a sort of pink powder inside, and you wet your toothbrush and just dab it in. So
it wasn't nice, but you bought it anyway because it had Dandare on it.
My mother bought it under my direction because of what I was really after, of course. Was these cards which were inside. So each tin of this stuff came with a card. You can see I've got a full pack here, showing various bits of kit and people out of the Dandare stories.
So these were a bit like cigarette cards that you got with cigarette packets, or they were tea, I think, used to do those as well.
Absolutely. So Brooke Bond tea used to do something similar. And, you know, there's the lady we've just been talking about, a nice picture of Professor Peabody.
That's quite a lot of cards there. What, 20-odd cards or so?
Yes.
So you would have had to get through at least 20 tins, because you would have kept getting repeats, presumably.
I had the cleanest teeth in Derbyshire in those days. So,
shall I start the procedure, Supreme Leader?
No. I want them to be conscious.
I'll administer the adrenaline.
Where my theory of parallels between the modern world of space exploration and Dandare rather falls apart is when it comes to aliens. There's almost certainly alien life out there, but unless we're the victims of a sinister government conspiracy to cover up the evidence, we have yet to find it. Jerry Stone.
Well, there may in fact be life forms out there that will kill us when we get to Mars. They will be bacteria. We are not going to see little or large green men across the Martian landscape coming at us with ray guns.
They cut off our escape route!
Clever.
The way they swarmed on Galloway. That's how they must have killed the civvies. They didn't have a hope!
Steady, lad. Show some metal.
Although you never know what's lurking in the clouds of Venus.
I assume from the hovering throne that you're the Mekon.
The title is Supreme Leader.
Supreme Leader. What better way to celebrate first contact between two intelligent species than by a mutual exchange of knowledge?
Indeed. Yet I only count one intelligent species in the room.
You shouldn't be too hard on yourself.
I'm Ra Drawi, and I play the Mekon. The Mekon is an alien who, well, in his own eyes, he rules the universe. He's Venusian, or rather, rules Venus, and the people who are his followers are the Treen.
The Mekon is a very interesting villain in that he is highly intelligent, and he thinks he's cold and logical. But in fact, he's consumed by petty envies and jealousies and pride. And so, like the old theory of the Shakespearean tragic hero who had a fatal flaw, the Mekon does have the fatal flaw. What obsesses him is, I was beaten by humans. Why? How could I, the Mekon, be beaten by these puny humans?
You'll be wiping out your own people.
They opposed me.
That's millions of them. That's genocide.
Not genocide. Genesis. After one solar year, the toxin will have dissipated, leaving emptiness. A void ready to be filled.
A clean slate.
And I shall reseed my new world. New life ruled by order and reason.
He's extremely cool and calculated, and very logical. But when he is crossed, he becomes a child.
They think you've started a war. Guards, seal the doors.
Why are they being so stupid? Only yesterday the humans were paraded through the city. Every child knows it is impossible to get to Earth so quickly.
They hear it on the Ethercast, Supreme Leader. They know it is never wrong.
Can they not think for themselves?
Emotionally, he is very immature. He has not developed emotionally. He's got such a huge head, it's completely taken over everything. So he hasn't been able to control his emotions because he doesn't use his emotions. He doesn't express his emotions. When he's ordered to do things, he doesn't like it. I mean, literally, he's a child at heart.
Just imagine if he had a Twitter account. Unlike much of the science fiction of the 1950s, aliens in Dandare weren't all baddies, monsters to enslave the Earth. Nor did the humans always do the right thing. It's these nuances that have helped the stories hold up so well today.
It is you. Digby, he's here.
Get out. Get away now.
You're hurt. And a long way from home. What are you doing out here?
I'm the bait in the trap. Now please, get away.
Colonel, we've got company. Another ship bearing in. A right big bugger.
They're coming. Get yourself clear.
Not without you. Come on, lean on me.
My name is Bijan Danishmand. I'm playing Sondar. Sondar would be a Venusian version of Dandare. I think years of suffering under the teachings of the Mekon have brought him to become a rebellious person in the nicest way. He's a rebel, but he wants good change. And he teams up with Dandare to do that. He develops in the sense that he gains trust of the humans, and he trusts the humans. So the element of trust builds up, and as that does, the bonding develops as well. So when Dandare is suffering, Sondar feels for him.
The system's ready when you are, Professor.
Thanks, Sondar. Right then, uniforms off.
Uniforms? Isn't that a bit, well...
Not ashamed, are you, Dan?
No, I was thinking of you, but not like that. embassy.
It means your modesty, Professor.
Don't worry, Colonel. We can keep our small song.
Ah, right.
On your signal, Professor.
Thank you.
From the very beginning, long before Star Trek or Doctor Who, Dan Dare painted an optimistic vision of the future. When it launched in Britain, rationing was still in place and cities were still littered with piles of rubble after the devastation of wartime bombing. But the future looked bright and the space age was just around the corner. Today, despite global political events, there remains every reason to feel optimistic, particularly when it comes to our future in space.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff. At dawn, the dawn of Orion and a new era of American space exploration.
NASA is currently developing a new giant rocket and the Orion capsule, capable of taking astronauts beyond Earth orbit to the Moon or even Mars. Companies like SpaceX are pushing ahead with their reusable launchers, and innovators such as Alan Bond are developing space planes like Skylon. As we've heard, even advanced plasma drives are no longer out of the question.
If you regard this as a vision of what one would hope the future would be like, I think that is something that we can aspire to, and which, whilst we might not quite get it as simple and easy to pop into space as it is in Dunder, we'll certainly achieve something close to it.
Astronauts have lived on board the International Space Station since 2000. In the 21st century, there have always been humans living in orbit.
Dan, Digby, glad you could join us. This way.
And good morning to you too, Peabody. Nice place you have here. A bit pastel for my taste, mind. A bit sci-fi. Not to mention bloody huge.
Well, take a good look. It won't be pristine forever. I hear they're letting families on board.
How's your laboratory coming along, Peabody?
I'm having the particle accelerator installed on Tuesday. The fusion reactor comes on Wednesday. The tea-making machine is due Thursday, but they can't give me a time, so I'll have to wait in all day. It's a treen station, so the catering is still a bit odd.
I hope you're not telling me there's no tea.
Of course there is. Sir Hubert brought some up with him, and a kettle.
Hope you can find a plug that works.
Britain even has its own astronaut, Tim Peake, whose mission has inspired schoolchildren the same way Dan Dare did back in the 50s.
I'm a firm believer that the best science fiction, the best fantasy, is that has its one foot rooted in reality. What's interesting about Dan Dare, and it goes back to the likes of Tim Peake or, you know, even John Glenn. What a life that man led. What a representation of the brilliance of human spirit and ambition.
The optimistic Dan Dare vision of the future is as relevant today as it was when it was first conceived. Dan Dare is truly a 21st century British spaceman.
Look, I'm sure I'm supposed to say something here about keeping a stiff upper lip and all, but to hell with that. We fail, Uncle. All of us fail now and then. But it's what we do next that matters.
Thank you, Daniel.
Don't mention it. Seriously, don't. I have a reputation as a reckless flyboy to live down to.
Say no more.
Dan Dare, 21st Century Spaceman, was written and presented by me, Richard Hollingham. Sound design and post-production was by Alistair Locke. Original music, Imran Ahmad. The executive producer was Andrew Mark Saul. And this has been a Boffin Media production in association with B7 Productions.